time to forge the narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge Narrative. We are the Bella Lost Souls podcast. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. I'm joined today by Justin Troop and Chris Morgan.
What up, guys?
Salutations.
And Adam Abramowitz.
I really want it to be ATC again next week.
It was that good, man. It really was. Fun times. Andrew may be joining us later. He's tied up right now, so we went ahead and get going just in case. Chris, you came upon the trivia question from last week.
I did. Yes. The answer was Port Ma.
And that's the largest port in the Gothic sector or something? Is that what it is?
Yeah. It's kind of funny because I came across it while doing some heresy research. During the heresy, Horus ended up conquering Port Ma. And then it clicked that it was in the Gothic sector. I was like, oh my gosh. I had a moment of clarity and I had to message Paul right away.
Well, thank you.
So I'm
for
not
that.
Fired.
Yep, you did it. You did it. And hey, I don't know if you guys heard, but I talked to Jarvis.
I did.
Is that what that was?
That was a great show. I actually listened to it on my drive down to Atlanta before I had to swing up to Chattanooga. Great show.
Thank you. Just a pleasure to talk to you. It was really cool to see his enthusiasm for all these new things that are coming down the pipe, things like Stormcloud Attack and the General's Handbook for Age of Sigmar.
I could really tell from what he said that they're really getting invested in the idea of supporting multiple ways of playing the games.
Yeah. If you haven't checked it out yet, listeners, you can find it at Bella Lost Souls. They just posted it today. Today is Wednesday, so when you're listening to us, just backtrack. It's on Bella Lost Souls. And they can also find it where else, Paul?
Well, they can find it in iTunes, but also, believe it or not, on the Warhammer 40K official page on Facebook.
That's huge.
Oh, yeah.
That's huge. That's a big deal.
Thank you. I couldn't have done it without all the support from people listening on the show. And I was just real happy to get that opportunity. Speaking of opportunities, we're going to take a break here in a couple of minutes. And I'm going to lead into an interview with John French, Black Library author.
Yeah. You get an interview.
Did you go to like
get an interview?
Yeah, Nottingham or something. Like, how are you getting all these interviews?
I did record this one in the Games Workshop HQ.
That's awesome. It's good to have all this content too. You're getting some of this inside info. So I appreciate it.
Of course, I went to England for work, and while I was over there, I decided to jump up to Nottingham because you got to make that trip if you're in the area. But
can't work without a little bit of play.
Really cool to get that opportunity with these guys, and it's a neat. John actually plays 40K and Heresy, so it's going to be kind of interesting to talk to him about that. On this episode too, I want to talk a little bit about our ATC experience, and I want to talk about I struggle with how to make like hobby talk interesting. Talking about like painting and stuff, but I've got something I want to talk about weathering a little bit and the anxiety that I think some people feel with weathering.
There's many ways to mitigate that, and I'd be happy to help. And I know Chris is fantastic with weathering as well. So,
well, we're going to talk about that a little bit on the show today, specifically how you have to convince yourself that it's okay to put orange on a model you just painted.
It's small doses. Yeah, always reference Duncan. But yeah. I'm excited.
So let's take a quick break here. We're going to come back in to talk to Mr. French, and then we'll come back to us in about 15, 20 minutes or so.
I can't contain my excitement.
Talk to y'all guys in a minute.
FTN is also on Facebook. Please like us at www.facebook.com/ForgeTheNarrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to a very special part of Forge Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, and I'm joined today by John French.
Hey guys.
Thank you very much for joining me. I think it's fair to point out that we are at Games Workshop HQ right now doing this interview.
We are.
I mean, I'm excited. It's probably every day for you.
Not quite, but yeah, it is pretty exciting.
Yeah, normal, I guess. You have an uncommon characteristic to a lot of authors that I've spoken to. You actually play Warhammer.
I do, yeah. I play a lot of 40K and a lot of Horus Heresy. Yeah, so I have a very large Heresy army of a mixture of Mechanicum, a knight, one knight at the moment, and some Blood Angels, and I have a huge Chaos army in 40K, which is mainly Night Lords, some demons. Quite a lot of demons. More demons than I normally remember that I have.
I'm not going to judge you, but I want to know what knight that you chose to go with your mechanical force.
I made it's a knight errant. It's the standard knight errant with the thermal lance.
That's a solid choice. Yeah, it's good. Yeah, it's not too bad. Yeah, I was hoping for like a Lancer or something.
Oh no, that would be awesome. Don't get me wrong. That would be completely awesome. But yeah, it's I needed something to try and kill all of the super heavies on the other side and things like and Sparkles, of course. Yeah, and so I thought the thermal option was the best one to go for that.
Yeah. Not bad. You also play the games like Silver Tower.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, I've got my copy of that a couple of weeks ago, and that's an amazing
game. How brilliant is that game? I mean, it's just something for everybody to do, even if they're casuals, and I'm using the air quotes that they can't hear right now.
Also, as a long-term fan of Chaos and Tzeentch in particular, those Zangor are just amazing. And the cultists and the Gaunt Summoner and all that. It's just, yeah.
This is just my prediction, but I bet we see Gaunt Summoner rules make their way into 40K.
Ooh, possibly. I don't know. I think though the amount of work that they've done to make those models look so unique as well. It's like for Chaos fans, that's the best thing ever.
Yeah. Oh, it is. I tell people, like, if you're a demon player, especially a Tzeentch player, you get the Demon Chariot kit to fill out your squads, and now you must get Silver Tower to fill out the rest of your squads.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Get two. so you can get that squad of Acolytes even bigger than six.
But I'm a fanboy. I've been gushing over it for weeks, but it hasn't lost its shine for me.
Oh, no, not at all. I think also I really like the story mechanics in it and the story kind of narrative, the way that unfolds as you play and all of the readout text that you get in the books. It's just great.
It is awesome. But I want to talk to you about some of the stuff that you've written. You've got a series of Horus Heresy content that's out right now.
Yeah, I've been working on the Heresy writing team for a while now. Started back in 2010, just at the end of 2010. I was a very new author to Black Library back then. I wasn't a new author. I'd just come off the back of writing for 40K RPGs, which some people may know about. So things like Dark Heresy, Rogue Trader, and the Deathwatch RPGs. And I've been working on those freelance for quite a long time. And I decided to try and get into Black Library because I've always been a fan of the novels. And I managed to get in. And I'd done a couple of stories. And then I very, very cheekily pitched a Horus Heresy short story called The Last Remembrancer, which features Rogal Dorn. And amazingly, much to my shock, they said yes, and then published it in the next anthology, which was The Age of Darkness.
Was it because it made Rogal Dorn cool?
I think it's because of the idea that I had in that. It was that this question of what happens to the Remembrancers, what happens to these people that are there to witness the Great Crusade, this amazing conquest of the galaxy, this thing that was supposed to redeem mankind. And then, of course, it all goes horribly wrong and is turned on its head by Horus betraying the Imperium.
Right, spoiler.
Huge spoiler. and Horus dies at the end. Sorry, massive spoiler.
Or does he?
But yeah, what happens to those guys when that thing they're supposed to witness starts going really, really bad? You can't really have that kind of idea of openness and free enlightenment and sharing of knowledge and ideas when the universe is now a dark place filled with literal demons. So it's kind of like, how would the Imperium cope with that? And that was really the point of that story. And yeah, it also let me get my first experience of writing Rogal Dorn, which is, I really like writing Rogal Dorn. He's one of the Primarchs. Primarchs are quite tricky to write because you really have to try and understand what their drives are, what their weaknesses are.
I think if I can interject, is we all have an opinion about what our Primarch thinks, believes, how he acts.
Yeah.
You know, how do you reconcile that when you're writing?
I think it's trying to understand the core of what they are, the core of their of what makes a Primarch a Primarch, but also what then makes them. Each one of them, the 18-ish Primarch, a unique manifestation of the idea of a Primarch. All Primarchs they're not really human. They are artificial beings that are more human than human. All of their characteristics are written on a vast scale. They have huge power.
Turned up to 11.
They're all hugely intelligent. They're all hugely powerful. But they're also, all of their flaws are magnified along with them. So any weakness that comes with all of their strengths is even larger. And knowing what those are is the key to writing. So with Rogal Dorn, for example, it's the fact that he will never go back. He will never take a backward step. That's his approach to everything. You know, met with any kind of challenge, his approach is to dig in and to never go back, to never relent, to never take a backward step. But he's also, the reason he does that is that he's an idealist. He actually believes in what he's doing. He believes in the Imperium, the Great Crusade, the reasons for doing it. And the weakness in that is that he's, the Horus Heresy starts to enter a situation where he's going to have to start to make compromises. And he's not the kind of guy who makes compromises. It's not his nature. So that's really interesting. And then one of the things about the other Primarchs is when you start to get into their headspace is what is, they're not all the same. What are those great strengths and weaknesses? And it's like Magnus the Red, for example, a thousand sons. He's incredibly powerful. He knows a huge amount. There's probably, the Emperor, no greater intellect in the entirety of the Imperium. But he is incredibly limited in some ways, blind by his own knowledge.
He's only got one.
He's only got one. But he also can't see that his knowledge blinds him because he thinks that he knows everything, which means that ultimately he doesn't know.
In that story, we've all either someone's told us about the couple of paragraphs that existed about that before, or we've dreamed it up in our head or whatever. It was very, very interesting to see all that all play out and then how all the novels intertwine with each other, like Outcast Dead. Outcast Dead is one of my favorite in the series.
Yeah.
Almost specifically because it happens to touch on some of the stuff that with Magnus and other things.
Some of the after effects of what he does to try and communicate with the Emperor.
Yeah, I mean, it's just that whole, that mesh. So when you're writing this stuff, how much of it is done in a vacuum and how much do you get to actually, I guess, connect the dots behind the scenes, even if it hasn't been connected for us in the novel?
You mean with other authors?
Yeah, or storyboard or whatever.
It's, a lot. We do a lot of work behind the scenes talking about characters. I think the best way of looking at it is that each author that writes in the Heresy brings their way of expressing things and their way of interpreting things to the table. So you get, which I think is amazing. So when, for example, Dan Abnett writes something, like, for example, Gilliman in No No Fear, then you get the same core of character, but expressed as Dan would express it. And we put quite a lot of work into that part of it. What are the core of, what's the core of these characters? And yeah, a lot of that actually just comes down to us talking. It's a really nice group of writers, the Heresy writers. We all know each other really well and talk a lot outside of writing our books. But then, of course, we all have our individual ideas on what stories would be cool and how exactly to tell stories and what would be really interesting for a character. And with some characters, sometimes we talk about things like I did Perturabo and Alexis Pollux in a novella called Fist, which I knew going into that I was going to hand off those two characters.
Pollux, such a tragic story. I want to show you what I'm going to tell you what I how it affected me. But go ahead.
Sure. I knew that those two characters. I knew that Alexis Pollux. He had quite a developed arc. He was going into Imperium Secundus and part of that arc. That I was going to hand him off to Dan. So Dan and I talked quite a lot about who he was and where he was going and all the rest. And then passed him to Dan and Perturabo. We knew that he was going to be Angel Exterminatus by Graham. So handed off to him. And then I knew I was getting him back after Angel Exterminatus for the Talon novella and Executioner and the Talon novel called Ironclad. So I knew I was going to get him back. So we talked quite a lot through that, kind of like, who are they? Where are they now? Where are they going? Where are you going to take them? But also sometimes sometimes stuff happens in the writing. Cool ideas happen or character developments happen that you don't expect during the writing of a book. And then sometimes you have to go back and go, so this happened to him now. So we're going to have to take that into account, that's actually some of the really exciting stuff as well.
I bet that sounds fun to kick back and okay, cool.
Guys, I did this.
What?
You've got to deal with that now.
Where I was going with Pollux is he's got a great figure.
Yeah.
His rule's pretty good too. I mean, it's something you want to play with, want to use. And then after you read the story, it becomes almost an inspiring figure.
Yeah.
But we know he doesn't make it to the 41st millennium.
No, he doesn't. No, he makes it pretty close. Because we know that from the background of the Crimson Fists chapter, that he lives even for about, I think, 800 years or something like that after the Heresy. So he makes it a good long way, but then in the end he dies. But I think he's really interesting because you can see the characteristics, his characteristic in the chapter that, you know, he founds the Crimson Fists, which is almost part of the Imperial Fists amplified up again, which is this sort of thing of, they will pay any price, that's asked of them, if our job is to stand here and get massacred, then we will do that because that's what we were created for. And that's very much what Pollux is like. And that kind of heritage follows them throughout and all of the millennia that come afterwards until you kind of hit the Crimson Fists and the place where they're at in 40K.
But people, I guess they kind of have an idea that the Imperial Fists are kind of a vanilla legion, the ones that don't have all the bells and whistles that are some, but then these characters have really brought them to life. And you guys are responsible for that. Did that challenge factor into did you have that even on your mind when you were writing some of these things?
I think, yeah, we always have that some of that kind of stuff on our minds. How are we going to make this Legion authentic and appealing and interesting? And that varies sometimes depending on how much has been said about them already. Sometimes actually it's just a case of taking what has already been said but not shown and showing it. So with the Imperial Fists, we actually knew quite a lot about them, but we knew that they were siege specialists, that they had become the Praetorians of Terror during the Heresy, that was basically their job to defend the solar system. And we knew then that after the Heresy, it all goes quite wrong for them because Rebel Dawn doesn't like the idea of individual chapters, which is Gilliman's idea, and the Codex, he doesn't like that. And so he almost goes to war with the Imperium again, holding the Iron Cage, and they end up with this this kind of sort of tragic history. We also know that that Sigismund founds the Black Templars.
When when you see him come on the novel scene first, I guess it was in the second or third book or so, I think.
It's early in the series.
It's just like, you just get tingles. Just like, oh, what are we going to see?
Yeah. And he was fun to take forward. He's in, obviously, the novel, the novella, Crimson Fist, and I did an audio drama, Templar, which is just all about him, really. And I think he's really interesting. I think he's a really, really interesting character because he's the other bit of the Imperial Fist. And he's a fanatic, an idealist, but also he's aggressive as opposed to we'll stand here and take it. He is all about forward energy, forward movement, constant. That's what he's a crusader.
It's kind of interesting to me that, I mean, I guess in my opinion, all of the legionaries or whoever they are a manifestation of something inside their own Primarch.
Yes.
And to have it, to me, it's almost like that's his extension. That's Dorne, you know, having him do what Dorne can't do because Dorne's a certain way, but that's what he appreciates.
I think it's interesting. Actually, Dorne can be like all of these things. Okay? Yeah. But I think depending on where he is at, it varies. So Dorne is like all of his sons. He's like Pollux. He's also like some of the other Imperial Fist characters that we haven't met yet. And he's like Sigismund. He is a crusader, but he's also a builder and a sacrificer and a holder of the line. But he moves between those extremes. So during the Great Crusade, he was probably more like Sigismund. Then during the Heresy, he becomes more like Pollux, and then he comes out into something else.
Oh, that'd be really cool to read about it. I just bringing emotion to these characters that we've got these perceptions again. Yeah, that's kind of the whole thing. Is that this is you guys are wrestling with things that has existed for 20-25 years or whatever before. So we've all had the time to all play this out in our head, and it's so awesome to see this. It's not blowing smoke. It's better than I think that we had in our head this whole time.
That's great.
And once you mentioned like the Remembrancers and stuff, I mean, when I first read about those, I'm like, oh, where are they going with this? I wanted to see Space Marine battles, and I'm like, what's happening with this Remembrancer? You know?
Yeah. Well, I think that's part of our job, really, is to tell people the stories that they kind of think they know, but in ways that they didn't expect. So it's not so much really about sort of rewriting what's established, but it's about showing what it was actually like, what these characters were actually like, and sometimes going, well, I bet you thought that this character was like this. They're actually a bit more like this. I mean, I remember the first time you see Horus Rising, where the first line he says is actually this really kind of charismatic and actually kind of casual thing to Loken. And you're like, whoa, I was not expecting him to be like that. But it makes complete sense given what he is like. And yeah, trying to do that to give a story that we all know over in a way that people don't quite expect yet is what our job is.
Kind of just a fluff question here.
Mm-hmm.
Who's your favorite character to write about?
Who's my favorite character to write about? Hard, tough question. I think in the Horus Heresy, I would probably probably actually say, yeah, it's probably Rogador. In 40k, it's Ahriman. I spent a lot of time when I was doing the Ahriman trilogy in his headspace, and it's a dark place to try and write Ahriman, but I love writing because he's a really fun character to take places and do things.
He's another one of those characters that it's been around for a long time and just has. You can tell he's a bad Mamba Jamba.
Yeah,
and nothing I've read about him disappoints. I promised you. Well, John, let's go ahead and wrap this up. And I mean, thank you very much for taking the time with me. Is there anything else you'd like to cover before we get out of here?
No, it's all good. Thank you very much for having me on.
All right, thank you.
FTN is brought to you by Bell of Lost Souls. Check out www.bols.org for the best daily hobby articles on the web.
Hey everybody, we are back. I hope you enjoyed that interview with John. Just a really cool guy. And again, I kind of talk about the fact that he plays 40K, 30K, which is not always the case with some of these authors. I know that, it's really cool to see them when they do, though.
It just makes me want to go over there and play him.
Yeah. Those are cool narrative battles. Yeah, you just heard Chris Morgan and Justin Troop.
Hello.
Hello.
Andrew Whitaker, as promised, joining us, and Adam Abramowitz.
Short of shorts in 40K. I don't think that you won that battle. Well, Paul Murphy.
Several of us are back. Several of us are back from the ATC this past weekend. Wonderful time. It's basically right outside of Chattanooga. A lot of people, 48, 50 teams of five folks converging to play some very competitive 40K. And some interesting list builds came out from it. I know we haven't talked too much about our list along the way, but I want to talk about some things that just really worked that maybe could help some other players that are looking for different things to do out there. And I think I've got my list is something you people would expect from me with like a Death Star-y type list. There are a couple of different elements in there that I think really worked that I want to pass on to folks. And I know, Andrew, you've got a very novel Dreadnought list. I think you were planning on playing this before, but the most recent FAQ certainly helped. And we even got a Chaos FAQ we're going to touch on during this part of the show, too.
Did you punch twice as hard?
Quite literally twice as hard. It's actually funny because I was building and painting this list before the FAQs came out. And it wasn't just the +2 attacks, the Dreadnought list FAQ, Dreadnought attacks that helped me. It was that. It was the you only get one grenade in close combat, right? So then I was no longer afraid of swooping hawks with all the haywire. That FAQ also helped me. And then the FAQ that said D-size hitting open top transports is now strength 4, right, with the flamer templates. So it was a combination. It was like this random kind of luck of the draw series of FAQs that got released that made my list way better, just all of a sudden kind of overnight. And it was great. It was very successful, and I had a really fun time. And as Paul mentioned, ATC is most competitive team tournament in America every year. It's 250 of the best players from across the country. I mean, you have people flying in from California, Chicago, literally anywhere you can name a place that is kind of a mecca of 40K or a focal point of 40K. There are players there and with teams, and it's incredibly competitive, but in a good way. And I think it's really fun. And I was talking to one of Paul's teammates, Ricky Addington, who's a friend of the show, a phenomenal painter. And Ricky and I were talking about, like, it's almost like a family reunion, and you get to see these guys that you don't see all the rest of the year. In the middle of summer, we all show up in Chattanooga and hug it out and play some phenomenal 40K, which is a lot of fun.
It's a great analogy. I mean, it's everybody's there to play really hard, and I think you're there to play maybe even a little bit harder than you would in a normal individual GT because you're playing for four other people. And that's a whole different element.
Sometimes you got to lose hard for those other people, too. We certainly talk about the psychology along the way. But, let's get right into some of the weird things that work. You get to see, with these 250 people playing, you get to see 250 different lists. Now, some of them are kind of cookie cutters of whatever, but you get to see some exceptions and some things that people bring to kind of bust open the meta. And I'll start with mine because it's pretty basic. I put a Wolfguard Terminator in a pack of Grey Hunters that come down in a pod. So the kind of the sweet tech there is using that Terminator to disrupt things in the backfield. I put a Combi Melt on him, and he comes with a Power Sword. And I'd kind of downplayed the Power Sword, but the Power Sword in today's meta has a place when you're dealing with Gladius and people in flak armor and that kind of stuff.
Well, especially for the things that are going to try to dislodge you from that objective, because your whole point was you're dropping in on an objective with objective secured, and then you have your tank. So that guy sending his Razorback with five guys in it, you're able to eat those five guys up just that much better. I know me and you went back and forth about this, a whole how are we going to kit out a Wolf Guard guy and this whole Grey Hunter thing. And I wasn't all in, but I mean, you got to go down there, you did your six games, and ultimately it worked out really well. So
to think about just the way the things in 40K work, the same thing that you need to shoot at the pod is typically the same thing you need to shoot at the Terminator. So unless you've got two of those things available, you can't kind of mess around. You have to really prioritize and then hope to get a little bit lucky.
I mean, it's kind of the same thing that Andrew had going on with his list, AB-12 or AB-12, right?
You know, you're trying to create target confusion. And anytime that you're making your opponent make these decisions about what they do, I think you're in an advantageous spot. With things like Razorbacks with heavy bolters, I mean, they don't really kill Marines very well, and they certainly don't kill a Terminator very well.
We all know that I'm not the greatest 40K player in the world. The one thing that I've learned to do is force my opponent to make a decision, whether it's a bad decision or a good decision, a decision that I can capitalize on. And that's exactly what you're speaking to right there,
Paul. So when you drop a squad with a Flamer and a Combi Melta and basically somebody just to take saves along with a drop pod in the back of somebody's line or on an objective somewhere, you start to, if they don't address that, especially in a progressive objective type game, then it becomes increasingly worse for them to deal with as the game progresses, because you are removing the threats to those pieces. So, you know, kind of the secret sauce there is including the Space Wolves specifically can put that Terminator pretty easily in that unit.
And the thing about the Terminator, too, even in a close combat situation, you're talking about Power Sword. Power Sword comes with the upgrade, so you're not paying extra for the Power Sword, which means that the guys that are going to come into combat that are going to try and challenge out your Wolfguard Terminator, if they have the AP2 weapon, they're usually swinging last. They generally, unless they're also Terminators or another point intensive unit, are not going to have the same resiliency as the Terminator. There's a good chance that he'll be able to cut through their armor.
Yeah, and nobody's taking stuff like Terminators. I mean, you're going to see, of course, you see Thunderhammers and Power Fist and that kind of stuff, but you're not seeing big units of Terminators right now in the field. And let me tell you, these Terminators kill lots of Power Armor Marines and lots of Imperial Guard and stuff over the weekend.
Tell you what I was impressed with in my games was Wolfen. I didn't, you know, it's interesting. Everyone's all on fire with the Thunderwolf Stars, especially in the Death Star format. But man, I will take Wolfen over Thunderwolf Cavalry 5 days a week.
Wolfen get to attack twice.
Insane.
I'll tell you why. Because Wolfen get to run and assault, and they're fleet. So the big bonus to Thunderwolves is that they have a 12-inch move, which is great. But and everyone says, well, they're faster than Wolfen. That's why you can't build a Death Star around Wolfen. And I say the nay for a couple of reasons. One, the Iron Priests are going to be on Wolves, and the Wolf Guard Battle Leaders and the Wolf Lords are also going to be on Wolves as well. So you're going to get that guaranteed 12-inch movement. But just as importantly, the individual Wolfen get to run and then assault. A fleet run on average is like 4.5 inches. So let's round up to say 5. So you're almost guaranteed, and then the instinctual behavior, you add 3 very often, rather. You add 3 to your run and assault. So if you're a Wolfen player, you move 6, you run on average, including +3, 7.5, 8 inches. And then you would add to assault +3. You come out better than just a stock 12-inch movement. And you get to attack twice. You're guaranteed to attack once. You potentially get to attack twice. You're still that same strength 10. All of the attack bonuses are there. And then the Thunderhammer Storm Shields are huge. I mean, I played 3 Wolf Stars this weekend. I played 3 Thunderwolf Stars this weekend. And the one I was most impressed with was the one that was 10 Wolfen strong. That one was...
That's a commit right there.
How many axes were in there, buddy?
It was 8 Hammer Shields and 2 sets of claws.
Really? I like the axes because you're swinging at initiative on the turn you charge and you're getting that AP2 out of that. It's interesting that people are using the claws still. I don't like the point difference.
It doesn't matter because if you kill them, if they're swinging at initiative, they get to swing still.
Well, and then your Thunderwolves are getting there. To Troop's point, right? I mean, yeah. If you're swinging at initiative, then you're swinging at 4. And then if you die at one, because of the way the wound allocation works, you can pretty much control when those particular guys are actually going to take wounds. And let's not forget, these guys with a shield, with a storm shield, they're two wounds with a 3+ save. You know, like, that's not to be overlooked. Look, you take a two wound space marine with Feel No Pain, it was so strong. That was the one game I got less than 15 points. Was against that particular Thunderbolt Star, because when I hit it with the Dreadnoughts, it was like, it was mutually assured destruction, but I was the only one that was assured of destruction, because I, you know, even if I kill these Wolfen, they're still going to get to swing at strength 10. They're going to blow up my Dreadnoughts. And as long as they make 3+ saves, they're going to be totally fine. And I was like, whoa, it was just that such was like a shell shocking moment. I won that game purely based on my objective secure. Oh, I had so much OBSEC, so I got to win progressive, and I got to win the Emperor's Will objectives. But the kill points thing, I just couldn't compete, even with the Dreadnoughts and all of their swings at strength 10. I just couldn't kill the Wolfen.
That's awesome. It's like he was the perfect counter to your counter.
Kind of where we're going though is, don't count the Space Wolves out. Now, I don't think anyone really has, but there's things in the list that still compete really well. So if you are a Space Wolf player, you know, you still can hang with the big boys.
Yeah, certainly. It certainly caused me to reconsider. I mean, obviously, when I walk up to a table, and I'm not castigating Paul or anyone else who plays a Thunderwolf Star. But when I walk up to a table and somebody hands me a list, especially at ATC, you know, to everyone who's listening, you guys know the feeling if you've ever been to ATC. But if you haven't, you know, you walk up to a table and your captain hands the opposing team 5 lists, and their captain hands your team 5 lists, and you look at them, and as soon as I pull one out that says, the first thing at the top of the sheet says, you know, Chris Morgan or Justin Troop, and then it breaks down his list and it says Company of the Great Wolf. I don't even flip the page to. I know exactly what that list does.
You know what to expect.
It's a Thunderbolt Star.
In my list, the other sweet thing is running a double Death Star. Had a Sanguinary High Priest running with some Thunderwolves. And then if I felt like it, I'd throw an Iron Priest in there for some extra punch. And let me tell you, when primary Death Star A let me down, Death Star B was always right there holding it down.
Yeah, I love that dual star mentality.
I don't believe in the dual star, just from a list building kind of theory. My theory hammer doesn't. I'm like, I wouldn't
it
do a dual
it
hammer.
It don't jive.
Well,
it doesn't jive
in,
for my
in an environment
time.
To where you have to deal with, say, you know, you're going to have to deal with something like a committed shooting list like Tau. I also do not believe in the dual Death Star mentality, because you are diluting the purpose of that unit. But in an environment where you can pick your matches, it was almost perfect. Or have a hand in your matches was almost perfect.
Yeah, that's not one thing about the ATC dynamic, that your general list building mentality has to change beyond the I am designed to take all comers sort of thing, or I'm designed to do one thing really well. If you are designed to do one thing really well, chances are you're going to be paired against the person that your list works the best against. And you can kind of trust in that a little bit more than tournament.
It's interesting you bring that up. I mean, So this particular year was a brand new pairing system at ATC, and I love that. And credit to Shane and the guys who came up with it. Because in years past, it was much more rock, paper, scissors. It was a lot of, I throw out my rock, and the other team gets to see the rock and decides, all right, well, we're going to pair it against paper. You guys throw out scissors, and so we're just going to beat it over the head and shoulders with our rock. It was a lot more hard countery. This year, there was much, much less hard countering. It was clear that you had to bring much more take-all-comers styles lists. There was a lot less, I know what's going to happen in this game before we even roll dice. So why even bother?
I would agree with that 100%. I mean, I was there in years past, but I could just, based on how the matchings work, I can agree with you 100%.
It's a lot more dynamic. I don't want to spend too much time on that. And I also don't want to make it seem like I'm suggesting the dual star build either. The tech from that would be to the Terminators and the pods. Very effective, I think, even in a traditional 3-rounder, 5-rounder. That would still work. But Andrew, let's talk about your list a little bit, because that is exciting. We mentioned the kind of the perfect storm of FAQs and rulings, but I don't know if we mentioned yet that it was a full Blood Angel build.
Yeah, so it's funny that you mentioned that. I walked up to round six, the final round of the tournament, and my team was playing essentially for second place, but we were still well in contention to finish second or third in the tournament. And we walked up to the final pairing against the team that actually eventually won third, and the captain of that team just looked at me and he was like, "So what is this?" And I said, it's a single CAD Blood Angels. Single codex, single CAD. And that's it. And he looked at me and he goes, "Dude, good on you. Good on you."
Don't you just love that condescending little thing that people do when they see, oh, it's red?
You have to understand that I think there's a little bit of tongue-in-cheek there where they're like, good for you. But they're also like, all right, if this guy's playing on top tables right now and we're gunning it out for second and third and this is Andrew Whitaker.
My Q-list celebrity status was on full display. So the list is essentially, it's 11 drop pods, six of which are Forge World Lucius pods. And then of the single cat, I have two Librarian Dreadnoughts at Mastery Level 2.
Which nobody uses.
Yeah, I had never used them prior to building this.
Well, before, I mean, there was a brief period of time when they were actually pretty good in previous editions. And you could do the thing where, you know, you put wings on one and blew it over. I mean, there were things you could do that were interesting before, but they have been on the shelf for a long time.
Yeah. Well, since they moved to the HQ slot from the elite slot, for one thing.
Yeah, but about 4 years ago, back when you could choose your powers and the Blood Angels Dreadnoughts could, you know, or rather when they could take wings and still assault.
After you take the shield, one guy took the shield power, the other guy took the wings, and you worked it out.
Yeah, you could. There used to be some utility about 4 or 5 years ago, but nobody's ever seen Librarian Dreadnoughts. And so I had two of those in Lucius pods. I had three Contemptor Dreadnoughts filled up the elite slots. And then I had five troops choices. All in pods, including Cast of the Damned, who is a troop. So I had 10 objective secured units, 11 total pods, 6 Dreadnoughts and Lucius pods. And it's very, very difficult to deal with that amount of armor. You know, 11 drop pods, that's 11 AV-12 vehicles. That's 33 AV-12
with three hull points. I mean, it's
three hull points.
It's not an insignificant amount. It's easy to deal with a couple of them.
Right. The 11 is not easy to deal with. And I'll tell you what the other thing was. So on turn one, in a lot of games, night fight happens, right? In many tournament settings, if you agree with your opponent, then it's night fight. Otherwise, you roll for it.
Well, that's the rule book. That's actually a rule book set rule, right? That if you both agree, it can be. If you don't agree, then you roll for it.
Absolutely. And the Lucius pods have a fantastic rule, and that the turn they come into play in your opponent's subsequent shooting phase, they are shrouded. Well, so if it's night fight and I'm shrouded, then my now AV-12 three hull point vehicle is now a 4-up cover save out in the open.
Isn't anything that crosses the hull of the vehicle for line of sight, including the doors?
Including the doors. And the rules specifically say if a line of sight is drawn across your vehicle, including the doors, to a friendly model, then it's shrouded. So basically, when I drop a Lucius pod, which let's not, you know, cut corners, those things are 4.5 to 5 inches across in diameter. They're huge, plus the doors. You've got this big shrouded bubble. Everything is shrouded. Everything has a 5-up, 4-up, 3-up cover save. I mean, if I'm obscured and have shrouded and it's night fight, then my stuff has a 3-up cover save the turn it comes in. It's a huge problem to shoot at. And then, because it's an open-top transport, those Contemptor Dreadnoughts with the Carrier's Autocannons can shoot from inside the pod. It's an open-top transport. I kept explaining to my opponents, I would drop it in, and they would be like, "What do you mean you're going to shoot out of it?" And I'm like, "Well, it's an open-top transport. Think of it like a Venom." And they were like, "Okay, now I kind of understand it." And so I'd spool up that big Carrier's Autocannon. You know, I played a Demon player in round 3, for example, and I basically sprayed it with all this assault cannon shooting and killed a whole unit of pink horrors, including the two heralds that were in there, because I just double out the heralds. And he was like, "Wow, I didn't see that coming." And I'm like, "Yeah, they never do." Like, just whole units of blue of pink horrors were just dying. So all that to say, that list did very, very well. And it was, like I said, it was a single CAD Blood Angels list. And I went 6-0 on the weekend. I won all six of my games. And my team eventually ended up tying for fifth. And we had a very successful weekend, but it was a lot of fun to see that list be effective. I'll kind of wrap up with this. My last game in round six, I played against a very large Thunderwolf star, against a very successful player who finished second or third in Nova last year. Great player, giant Thunderwolf star, who had Azreal in the Thunderwolf star. And so I dropped the pods, and he multi-assaults and blows up three pods. And then I assault his Thunderwolf star with six dreadnoughts, and I swing at initiative. And people don't understand that the Blood Angel psychic power. So with a Blood Angel librarian, it's four base attacks plus one for charging. I rolled a three on the quickening, so I had nine attacks per dreadnought.
Six, seven, eight, nine
attacks per dreadnought, and I hit with six of them. So I had something like 48 attacks. Hitting on
three. They're strength 10, right?
I mean, strength 10. Yep. Add initiative. And a lot of them, because the Blood Angels Contemptors swing at initiative 5 on the charge, and the librarians are initiative like 6 or 7 because of the quickening. So I'm swinging at initiative 5, 6, 7 with 45, 50 strength 10 attacks, hitting on threes, wounding on twos, and I reroll the wounds because of shred. And so I hit him with this, and he started failing four ups on Iron Priests. And I'm like, yeah, it's strength 10. They're just doubled out. And so these Thunderwolf stars just start coming off the table. And at initiative 5, I do something like 17 wounds, and it eats all the way in to kill Azreal. And so Azreal's dead because of the way the wounds, you know, whatever. And now
you mentioned four ups on the Iron Priest, and that's because Azreal.
Because Azreal gives
that's because of his four plus and bold rule.
And so at initiative 4, Azreal dies. Or initiative 5, Azreal dies. And then at initiative 1, I had two dreadnoughts to charge through terrain with some 15 attacks. I hit on 10, wound on 10, and I kill the rest of the giant Thunderwolf star. And he just looks at me and he goes, "Thanks for the game, man. Go Blood Angels." And I was like, "Abso-freaking-lutely, dude. That was awesome." So it was a very successful weekend.
Because this is one of the things that even if you don't incorporate the full thing, there's some stuff that you can do if you're a Blood Angel player to maybe shake things up in your local environment. Because a quickening...
It's the Primaris power.
It's the Primaris,
it's the Primaris power.
You're absolutely guaranteed
one.
To get it.
Yeah.
It's Warp Charge 1. You're absolutely guaranteed to get it if you want it. And it's phenomenal.
Let's go down the full list of what the quickening does. Warp Charge 1.
It's a Warp Charge 1 power. It gives you fleet, guaranteed. Yep. And then
on the character you cast it on.
Plus D3. Yeah, you cast it on an individual character. And it gives you plus 3 attacks and initiative. Plus D3 attacks and initiative. So worst case scenario for a librarian, worst case scenario, you're at initiative 5 with 5 base attacks, which is tremendous. And then, you know, flip that script. Best case scenario, you're now sitting at 7 attacks at initiative 7. And at Warp Charge 1 power, it's very easy to get off. And so, you know,
on a front armor 13 chassis too.
On a front armor 13 with strength 10, and because you can take a blood talon, you can get shred with the 2 wound roll. And just as importantly, you also have force on that model. And so there's been a number of occasions since I started playing.
Just IDing people out.
I assaulted.
It comes with a Furioso Force Halberd. So when you cast this ability, so let's just say you get an average roll on quickening, and that's plus 2 initiative. You're now swinging an initiative 6, which is faster than what?
The Wraith Knight.
A Wraith Knight.
Bingo, bingo. I that was exactly the story. Paul, thank you for teeing one up for me. I assaulted a Wraith Knight out of my Lucius Drop Pod. I turned on quickening. I turned on Force, and I hit a Wraith Knight. At initiative 7 with 8 attacks, I hit on 5, I wounded on 5 with force, and I killed a Wraith Knight before it swung. Before it got the chance to hit back at initiative 7,
Great feeling.
And the guy I was playing against was just like, he had never even conceived of it.
Kills dreadnoughts all day long. He just like, it's his job.
That's how he punts them, right?
In his darkest dream, he had never even conceived of that being possible.
So the reason I'm putting so much emphasis on this, of course, like what we just described was possible before, but the thing only had 2 attacks base. Now, right. with the additional attacks, it's more reliable and you can at least compete. Whereas before, you're going in and maybe hitting with one and not doing a whole lot. You know,
that's like, oh, you passed your invulnerable save. Whoop-de-doo.
Yeah, exactly. The dynamic of the Dreadnought chassis, as far as when you want to put punch out there, it literally doubled. That's why I made that joke earlier. You know, did you punch twice as hard? You literally doubled your attack.
Twice as often. That's what.
Yeah.
And yeah, so exactly.
You're comboing with, you know, how Andrew did it with some of these great abilities, but there's other things out there that do use Dreadnought chassis. There's formations and things like that that can capitalize on this same concept.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, we were talking about Space Wolves earlier. I mean, I had a conversation after I played one of my opponents. We wrapped up early. We finished up on turn three, and he was like, wow, this is crazy. I didn't even think that that was possible. And so we were sitting there talking about it, and he said, could you do the same thing with Space Wolves? And I said, you absolutely could do the same thing with Space Wolves. Murder Fang is there. Bjorn is there. The venerable dreadnoughts with the three up
shield and axe,
three up invulnerable,
the shield and axe dreadnoughts are a big deal. That those are all things that you absolutely can do with Space Wolves. And, you know, I haven't set my mind to it, but I think you could absolutely build a comparable, if not better, list using the puppies.
A buddy of mine, you say that, a buddy of mine finished seventh in LVO last year using Space Wolves. It was nine dreads, 11 pods. Similar to yours.
That was before the extra attacks.
Exactly. That was the 2015, right?
My bad. Yeah.
That was last year, but it wasn't, just so the people know, it wasn't the most recent.
I think it's easy for people to hate on Dreadnoughts, even though we all love them. Like, again, you know, everybody on the show loves Dreadnoughts.
No, I only like Contemptors, not all.
still counts as a Dreadnought. But so anyway, we just wanted to make sure that people kind of get an idea of some of the stuff that may work, bring some life into your armies that maybe hasn't been there. Try something new on the tabletop. But we got a Chaos Space Marine FAQ today, and I don't know what the brevity of this FAQ means. I'm hoping it means good things for Chaos players, but this is purely an assumption. But it gave us the blanket Hellbrute extra attacks.
Yeah.
Similar to the Dreadnoughts. So what do? You see a rule like that and you start thinking about how do I make it work? You know, very similar to some stuff we just talked about. And I don't know if that's going to happen, but I do know that there's a Hellbrute formation with five Hellbrutes in it.
You get some Hellfist Murder Pack action.
And Justin, you got that pulled up.
Isn't that called the Mayhem Pack or some such nonsense?
The Hellfist Murder Pack is the five one.
What's the one that lets me deep strike them in? That's the one I care about. Banana Land. Right. If I can deep strike three or four Hellbrutes into somebody's lap, aren't they like 110 points a pop or something?
I can't remember what it's like. 105, right?
Yeah, 105. I mean, it's good. It's not groundbreaking.
It's a target priority problem for so many people. I mean, if I take two of these Mayhem packs or something like that, I haven't done the math on it, but if I can allocate, let's just say, 800 points of my list to a couple of these Mayhem packs, and I drop in.
Hang on a second. No, we need to tell people what this stuff does first. Then we can kind of riff about it. But let's get it out there what the formation rule is.
I didn't mean to jump on Troops Toes. I really thought we were talking about the same thing.
There are two that came out at the same time, and they both involve Hellbrutes. So we want to talk about the Mayhem Pack. You know, anytime we get new rules, we want to kind of go back and see how those apply to previous things that we may not have considered.
Yeah, so the Mayhem Pack is an interesting one. It's your three Hellbrute one. And this is playing along with how Andrew's concepts are with the deep striking, because this is the one that lets you deep strike. So the Mayhem from the Maelstrom.
Let you deep strike Hellbrute.
Strum? Is that a word? I don't know. But yeah, and it's on a single roll, the entire formation comes in. So it's kind of nice that you're only having to make that one, and they all arrive via deep strike. So that's pretty neat.
Yeah, I mean, realistically, so bonus attacks only matter if you're taking a close combat weapon, right? Because that's what's going to make you strength 10 and AP 2. And I think that the vast, vast majority of static gunline lists, we're talking Tau, we're talking a bulk of the Eldar lists, right? I mean, let's be honest here. Warp Spiders don't really want to deal with a ton of AV-12, or certainly not AV-13. A lot of the lists, and Thunderstars, right? Thunderbolt Stars really don't want to be looking at strength 10 straight in the teeth, because that's what's going to bypass their armor and their Feel No Pain saves.
You're playing a dice game at that point.
Exactly.
And you can easily come out on the wrong side of that.
no Thunderwolf player wants to be playing a dice game, especially because they're going to be losing the objective game because he has so many points to make that Death Star effective. Anyway, all that to say, let's look at this Mayhem pack, right? At what troop? Talk to me about what does a single Hellbrute cost with a
105 is what 105.
So for 315 points, I can take 9 AV12 hull points. That's going to come out around with all of which are 4 base attacks, strength 10, AP2. A ton of shooting when it drops, multi meltus, auto cannons, heavy flamers, whatever the combination of assault weapons you want to take are, and they'll deep strike with a single roll, which means, hypothetically, let's take 2 mayhem packs for something about, for 630 points, I could drop 6 Hellbrutes. 6 Hellbrutes. And then if you take, obviously, if you take 3 dragons, which I don't know why you wouldn't, Helldrakes, for those of you following along.
Helldrakes are still good, especially in this environment.
Phenomenal. So if I'm taking an air superiority wing of dragons, for example, lo and behold, I'm now sitting on a +2 to my reserve roll. So I need a 2+ to bring these Hellbrutes in, and I can drop in 6 of them on turn 2. They open up shooting. They're excellent in close combat. They will eradicate small units.
The shooting is not amazing, but they can take a multi-melta. I mean, there's things they can do that can disrupt your opponent.
It's not amazing, but
yeah,
it essentially
stock multi-melta, yeah.
But it also ignores a lot of shooting from opposing units. I mean, at the end of the day, if I see a unit of scat bikes, a dreadnought V unit of scat bikes, dreadnought's going to win. Hellbrute's going to win because they need 6s to glance me, right? So that's 8 hits. On average, they're going to do maybe a whole point and a half, and then I'm going to shoot them and assault them and end the game against that particular unit. I'll take Hellbrutes any day of the week, especially multiple mayhem packs. And let's not forget what troop just brushed over the top of it. It will not die. That is a huge, huge advantage.
Well, it will not die actually plays in this because the Hellbrute have a special rule called crazed. Each time a Hellbrute takes a glancing or penetrating hit but isn't destroyed, place a crazed marker by the model. Do you guys know about this?
It's crazy.
Yeah. It's crazy.
At the start of each of your movement phases, roll a d3 on the table below. If the Hellbrute has one or more crazed markers next to it, after rolling, remove all crazed markers from the Hellbrute. It's got a fire frenzy where the Hellbrute is immobilized until the end of your turn. If it's unengaged, it must shoot. If possible, the target must be a unit that has caused one or more glancing or penetrating hits on the Hellbrute in the previous turn. If not, the target must be the nearest invisible enemy. Rising Fury, the Hellbrute immediately recovers from crew stun and crew shaken results and has the rage special rule until the end of the turn. You know, that doesn't suck. 3 is Blood Rage. The Hellbrute immediately recovers from any crew stunned or crew shaken results. It has the Fleet and Rage special rule until the end of the turn. If, during this turn shooting phase, the Hellbrute is not within maximum charge range of an enemy unit, it must run as far as possible towards the enemy unit. If it's not possible for any reason, then it has to fire its weapon as normal.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes them fun because, you know, it's forcing you to constantly pressure your opponent. So keep that in mind when using this. Like you're out of control of the control that you have on the unit, so to speak. So it's an interesting mechanic, but it doesn't suck totally. Like you don't want to roll a 1 or a 2 on the crazed table. That's about it.
Well, the 2 is, I think, what, charge into combat?
Well, I can live with that. Yeah, on a D3, yeah, the 2 and 3 are good.
Oh, I get you. I see what you mean. My apologies. Yeah,
using the D6 mentality because math is hard for me.
So, but again, this is just another excuse to go back and look at things. Like every time I see something new, I will break open the codexes and just take a look and see what's in there. These are armor 12, so not as, I guess, as impressive as the Contemptor Dreadnoughts or for
Furiosos. They're not as good as the Furiosos, but yeah.
But I think it's fair to say that this would apply to like Chaos Contemptors and stuff, right? The extra attacks?
Certainly.
If it applies to the Imperial, like if it doesn't apply to the Chaos Contemptors, it wouldn't apply to the Imperial Contemptors, which means I cheated everyone all weekend.
I don't think you did.
I absolutely believe that the Contemptors are +2 as well.
Yeah. See, there was another formation that I'll run over real quick, but this is the Hellfist Murder Pack one, and that's the 5 Squadron one. So now they're walking, so to keep that in mind, right? But, you know, you'll get to where you need to get to eventually, hopefully. But it's allowing you to use your you'll have one champion in that unit, and it's allowing you to use the other guys within 6 inches to take lookout serves for the champion. So that's kind of like an interesting mechanic. Like, you get to keep that one guy alive to an extent, because you can kit him out a little bit differently, basically, and then use those cheaper dudes with less kit to keep him going. So when you get to where you're at, you're with the most gear that you want to be at with. I think that's pretty neat.
I don't even mind that. I
absolutely love that formation.
I mean, think about when you get fleet on those guys and rage, and there's more of them that maybe make it into combat. I mean, I don't think that sucks.
So what I love about this is that it's a single squadron, which means if I cast a psychic power on that unit to buff them, he gets all of them. That's a huge deal. You can't underestimate that. And then let's talk about the fact that it's a single squadron, which means it's a single kill point. You have to kill 5 Hellbrutes to get a single kill point. And then let's talk about the fact that it's under 550 points. No, I mean, that is upside, upside, upside. You turn that thing invisible. I mean, it's going to kill knights. It's going to kill anything it touches. It has a massive, massive footprint. I mean, a vehicle squadron is 3 inches, right, Paul?
No, 4 inches.
4 inches. I mean, think about how big of a footprint that is with 5 60-millimeter bases and a 4-inch coherency. You're talking about roughly 30 inches left to right across the board. I mean, if I'm at the top of the turn, I move 6 and run with that thing, I'm basically in midboard with this giant unit of dreadnoughts. How awesome is that? I love it. I love it.
Another nice thing about this one with the pack leader, this is another reason why you want to keep him alive too, is while the champion is still alive, for the craze table, you get to pick.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you can get that rage right then if you need it.
Yeah. So if you want to run, you know, you pick that one and get to where you got to get to and make some things happen. So it speeds that unit up somewhat, like I was saying, and it just – you're getting to do what you want to do. And I think that putting that kind of control in something that, you know, we would kind of consider not the best of units by itself, well, I think that it gives it play.
Chaos needs help. I mean, and people, I think, if you're playing Chaos and you're winning with Chaos, you're probably playing a singular list. There's like a linear path to victory, which we talk about, you know, is not always exciting. If you're a Chaos player, have a bunch of starter sets to get all your cultists laying around, you probably got a few Hellbrutes laying around, this might be something interesting to do.
Yeah, I'm for sure about to dig through my collection, because I know I bought like 5 Dark Engines.
Although I know I've cut up several Hellbrutes for Demon Princes.
It is a good model to convert with.
I mean, anytime, and I was talking about this, so the GWFAQ recently made it such that you cannot consolidate off of a walker. It says, if you end combat, a walker is destroyed, you do not make a consolidation move. I think that's a pretty terrible rule, right? Just from a common sense perspective, it's kind of nonsense that you can't consolidate off a walker.
It was easier before. Anything with a weapon skill you could consolidate from.
Right, but then they made vehicles weapon skill 1, and you know, you need 3s to hit them, and blah, blah, blah. But whatever the case may be, the ultimate output, the end result outcome of not being able to consolidate off of walkers is that walkers by necessitation got better, right? If opponents can't consolidate off of this unit now has more value.
Oh, if you're playing like Nurgle and you get that big template AP2 shot after people all bunched up and killing one of your Hellbrutes.
Exactly. Right. And so is ultimately, I was having this conversation with some buddies of mine today, and I was like, well, yeah, it's kind of a dumb rule, but I like it because it makes units that have been historically very, very bad, makes them just a little bit better.
Yeah, I can agree with that. So anyway, these are the things just to kind of maybe enhance your experience, bring some new life into old models, and just to get the ideas flowing. Maybe you see something different across the table. Maybe help your buddy build a cooler list. You know, I don't know. Speaking of helping buddies out, you guys know I'm painting some Skaven stuff for Age of Sigmar for a friend of mine. Skaven.
Real quick, before you continue, is this one of those like, so I have a friend who is really me,
it's me.
Friend and I play Age of Sigmar. Now, it's not me. I remind you, it's not me, but I have a friend who does these things.
I'm going all in on the Sylvaneth. I'm going to be playing Sylvaneth. And the Khorne, the Chaos Khorne stuff is calling me too. I've seen come across my Twitter. I've seen so many cool paint jobs on some Khorne. Like, I don't even know what they're called, but whatever those guys from the starter set.
Bloodbound or whatever.
Stuff from that new game coming out we saw. It's they just look awesome, and it's really speaking to my inner bloodlust. But painting this this plague furnace, it's got a lot of stuff on it, a lot of metal, and it's a really cool model, and I hope I'm doing it justice. But I got looking at the box art, and the box art has a lot more weathering than I'd previously put on it. Well, I didn't put any weathering on this. I was just kind of using washes to do what you do with the model. With washes, and I did put a little bit of oxide, the Nihilus oxide, on the brass parts to kind of bring some of that stuff out. It's pretty. And then I was kind of talking on the pre-show with the guys about how it's almost, you get a little anxious before you start applying that weathering, because you've got this well-painted model. You got this well-painted model, and you're about to essentially jack it up. You're going to be putting this pastel turquoise and this bright orange on it if you want to do rust. I mean, like, you're going to be doing, and then it just, in your mind, it seems like it's not going to look good. So what do you do? How do you psych yourself up to do it?
So it's not about psyching yourself up. It's about careful application and realistic application. So listen, it's one thing.
I had a life talk with myself. It is about psyching yourself up.
I still haven't managed to psych myself up. I've got weathering powders that I bought at Adepticon, and I just stare at them thinking, I got to try this.
Yeah, well, let's talk about weathering.
And I haven't done it yet.
And Adam, you're a great resource. I didn't mean to cut you off, but I just wanted to let you know there is that gut check moment before you just go medieval. And I'm actually good at weathering. I'm better at weathering than I am painting. So I think us talking about some different techniques may help some folks out.
Yeah, Paul actually does a really good job with, like, his chipping and scratching. It's if you've any of you have seen him on Twitter with his AdMech stuff, it looks phenomenal.
But it's not technique. I'm sorry, it's no innate talent. It's all technique, and I think you've got some innate talent you may be able to spark with folks.
So, from a talent perspective, it's not even talent. It's real life. It's what you see. So if you look at photos of a tank from World War II or whatever it might be, you see where the mud is and the dirt is and the dust is, that they come in different layers. And you have to approach your paint that way, because the paint works in layers. So it depends on what you're trying to achieve. So that's, and we could break that down into a dozen different segments, and maybe we will in more tutorials I'm trying to put out more, but let's just talk about and address maybe the fear of messing up a really beautiful model that you perfectly applied edge highlights to and recess washes to, and taking that step, because I think that's what you're trying to talk about, Paul.
Model that you have otherwise painted to what would be a tabletop or better than tabletop. You're proud of it. And now you're about to start taking, I guess, you know, a lead pipe and a blowtorch to it. I mean, that's best way to describe it.
Let me interject there, because, I'm a pretty prolific painter as well. I'm certainly not at Adam's level. But as a painter, when I approach a model, I've never once experienced what Paul is not describing, but what I'm understanding Paul to say, I've never gotten to the end of a model when I'm like, all right, this model is done. I'm going to put it on my shelf. I'm going to take a picture to it and send it to my grandma and brag about it. I've never gotten to that point and been like, you know what I should do now? Is slap it with GWFX paint. That's always part of the plan. That effects
exactly.
Paint is always, I always go into it knowing that this application of these effects paints and these weathering techniques, you know, I'm not a fan of weathering. I don't weather 95% of my models.
Well, Blood Angels do polish their armor before they go into battle. That's just a given. In fact, I think it says that in the Codex. I think it's mandatory. So
exactly. And, you know, we're the pretty boys of 40K, and so all of our stuff is to look pretty, but I don't like weathering. But
pretty and we don't know it.
A big chunk of my Black Templar army, I do have some weathering because it's a little more gritty. My stuff has some chipping, and the highlights lend itself to that. But from a modeling and painting perspective, I have never gone into a model thinking to myself, I'm going to paint this till it's ready to be sealed and then slap it with weathering. It's always about the weathering being part of the painting.
That's one aspect of it. You're building up to that. And there are certain times, obviously my ad mech, if you guys have probably seen my ad mech stuff, it's beat to all heck and back. And that was the design. That is what the intent was. And I knew I was going to do that. And you paint in a way that lends itself to that. And you know what you have to do to get the effects you want. And layers are a big part of that. So that is absolutely true. There's so many layers of just depth of color, and that's how you get that real realistic, just, you know, what using, you know, what modelers do, not gamers, like we're gamers. What real modelers do is they build in those layers and stuff. But I'm talking about maybe going in after the fact with just even a sponge and some brown paint. You know, how do you get to that point where you feel okay doing that? I mean, like today I took an old beat up dry brush that has essentially been worn down to what I would call a stipple brush at this point. And I'm stippling orange onto something that I thought I was done with. And it looks good. But, you know, convincing yourself to do that and knowing it's going to look good is difficult, I think.
So you guys are both saying true things. But what it comes down to is, first of all, you've painted your model. You know what the paint scheme is going to be. How are you going to base it, right? Because basing affects the weathering that it's going to have. If you're doing a desert scheme, it's not going to have mud stippled all over it and rust. And, well, maybe it might.
What if they drove through the mud to get to the desert?
It's probably not going to look too good. That's okay. We're playing in a fantasy world, right? What you need to do is step back and think about this first. I am going to do a mud base, or I am going to do a snow base, or I am going to do a Martian rust base first. But this, I think that the mental leap that you're talking about is very important, because a lot of people always say, and they say it to me, I don't know, like, I love the weathering that you've done. I'm afraid to do that. Well, it's Justin is a huge proponent for Duncan's videos, right, Justin?
Love it. He shows you all the different stuff in every step.
The smartest thing that he says is you can never take it off. You could always put more on later. Start small. Be light. If you're using a sponge or a stippling brush, like Paul was talking, or if you're even using powders, you know, which we can get into, and I could talk about that in depth, because, you know, powders are really fun and add a whole different element, and it's super simple.
It's texture that you're going for.
You'll need to give me some lessons on that sometime, Adam, because that's what I've got is powders.
I hope to do some videos sometime soon. It's a matter.
Well, let's talk about this. You're dancing around it right now. The idea, though, if you're going to muddy up, say you've got a tank or you've got a figure, or even if it's a large figure, let's say a dreadnought. We can use a dreadnought as an example, and you've got it on a mud base, and you're worried about, or you're curious about what's going to look good if you want to weather this up a little bit. If you're going with a mud weathering, then the same colors that you're using on the base is a safe choice. You can feel right. Good about doing that.
So if I'm doing, I'm actually working on a big Dark Angels project right now for a listener who I mentioned on the last show. You know, with a mud base, obviously you're going to be tied to a lot of browns, but when mud dries, it lightens in color, correct? So you lay down your mud, and Typhus Corrosion is, I think, a pot of paint that every hobbyist should have in their paint wardrobe, right? That they should have it on their desk when they need it, because it solves a lot of problems. If you mess something up on metallics or whatever it is, you just throw some Typhus Corrosion on there. But from a weathering point of view, you could do a lot with it. You can stipple it with a brush. I like to use it very lightly with a sponge that I've torn up. We all have, you know, blister sponge and foam, I should say, or, you know, our pick and pluck foam. But you got to be.
You can also get a sponge. You can steal the sponge from the sink, and it works similarly.
There you go. Yeah, just don't let your wife or your girlfriend know, or husband know. You know,
and don't use it for dishes again after.
Well, I like the taste, so I do.
But, sorry, I was muted, but that made me laugh. Sorry, yeah. Guys.
You just want to be light with it. You want to take your time with it and build it up. And then on top of that, so Chris, you were asking about powders. I use two different forms of powder. So I use a lot of Vallejo's powders. I also use, you know, Vallejo's pigments, I should say, and they come in a loose powder form. So you can get messy with it, and you got to be careful with it. It will stain everything. It's a true pigment. So once it gets set in there, it's going to stain. So if you have a nice carpet in your hobby space, that's going to be a problem. But you take this and you take it with a brush, you get it on there loose, and it will start to cake up, and it almost works like a dry brush, where it will sit on the edges a little bit more if you're using it dry.
Now, if you're to wet it down, it's going to be more like a wash. And when it dries, it has, as Paul was saying, more of a texture. But if you're laying that lighter color sand or lighter mud color over top of the typhus corrosion, then you have this really realistic effect where you actually have mud drying on top of wet, dirty mud that they're stomping through. But going back to what we were, you know, first saying, like the first step to doing this is picking your plan, as Andrew was saying. So I'm going to combine and jump back and forth between what Andrew and Paul were saying. You have to kind of pick the theme that you're going with. Start from there, because once you have the theme, you can't really mess it up. Then you can take it as far as close as you want it to be. You can make it as muddy as you want or just very little bit. Once you have that in place, then you can get in there and get gritty. And
so let's also not forget that from what Adam just said was a incredibly detailed and incredibly valuable. Anyone who wants to paint like one of the masters, go back and re-listen to the last like 7 minutes of the show. Absolutely essential stuff. But also from a holistic design perspective, you don't want to show up with half of your stuff looking one way and half of your stuff looking another. And so it's kind of one of those things where you have to fully commit to designing something like this. I mean, I realized probably about 3 years ago that if I want to outline my stuff together and have it look good, they all need to have the same basis. And so my Imperial Guard, my Blood Angels, my Black Templar, my Imperial Knights all have the exact same basis. They'll have to match. And so too is that true of the weathering technique. It is infinitely frustrating to me, not frustrating, but just like, you know, I walk up to a table and I see a guy who has, for example, a Thunderbolt Star, and he's got it's all very nicely painted, but you've got the Blood Angels contingent on Ancient Ruin bases, you've got the Space Wolf bases on Cities of Battle bases, and then you've got...
That's one of my pet peeves, I'm not going to lie. Exactly. But I don't want to get us too far off the mark here.
No, I'm not saying
going
that.
Back to pigments a little bit, I use a glaze medium or any kind of like anything of that medium level as a conveyor for the texture to get that on the model.
You're talking more of like a setter. So it's actually a fixer. It fixes the pigment on the model.
Because
you have to think about it like it's almost like a two-part epoxy to some degree. It's not.
It is. Because it won't just like stick on there by itself. You've got to make it stick.
Yeah. If you don't seal it, it's going to get all over everything and continue to do so. Every time you pick it up, you're going to have stuff on your fingertips that will stain your clothing and the rest of your model.
So what I do is I put a little of it, like the glaze medium in a bottle cap or just on my, so I've got this, I don't even know what the top of it's a metal top that I like mix all the stuff that will eat plastic in that thing. So occasionally that's where I'll run my oils and my pigments out of and brush in a little bit of the medium, brush a little bit in the pigment. I put it where I want it. You can get real, I guess, precise with how you apply it. And I think where the big takeaway here on this kind of stuff is do it in steps and in layers. And you will get a really nice effect. You can get as gritty as you want. But for starting the process, there are some things that do look good, even if your instinct tell you that they don't. And using things like Nihilus Oxide on brass, if you do it in a sparing way, build it up to your desired level of blueness. Because in the real world, you can walk outside and see that happening. That's what color it will turn when it is oxidized.
You have to use real world sourcing materials. You know, get a picture from online and use that as a reference material. If you're going for a realistic weathering effect,
well, I'm not even talking about realistic. I'm just talking about just if you just want to have a weathering effect on your stuff and you don't know where to start, the technical paints or the colors. Like I don't use RZA Rust. I use orange paint.
Huh. That's interesting. Yeah. I actually use
same color.
The dry, yeah. So I like the GW dries. I think they're nice.
So one thing I'm just going to recommend to anybody that before we forget about it, because we talked about pigments, Chris brought it up. If you want to play with pigments, get an airbrush. It doesn't matter if it's an expensive one, get a cheap compressor and a cheap airbrush. Because the best way to seal this is with like 2 to 3 coats of a matte medium through the airbrush. You know, water down the matte medium a little bit, spray it lightly, let it set, spray it again. You don't want to pull it up because then whatever you applied, it's going to start to turn a light blue because the matte medium has an inherent blue color to it. So you got to be really light with it.
but that's going to save you a lot of time. You know, laying the matte medium on with a brush over top is not going to help you any.
No, you want to spray. And I use, if you want to, even if you don't get an airbrush, the testers, what is it, Model Master stuff, is, I swear by, is never done me wrong. It is never glossed. It is never clouded. It has never done anything that it wasn't supposed to do. It just works.
That's a lacquer-based one, though, so do it in a well-ventilated area for sure.
Yeah,
absolutely. Oh, oops. I'm just kidding. When you're running anything like that, get a respirator is also a good investment. A good one, protect the nose and the mouth. I'm sure it will pay off benefits. So I guess we're getting a little bit advanced, and I wanted to talk about just where to start. And where to start is, I mean, the box art on some of this stuff is a good indicator of where to start. Like, I looked at it, and I'm like, man, they put rust on this, like, cow catcher or whatever this is in the front, and I didn't do that. Let me get in there and do that. Now, I know I am comfortable sponging on orange, or in this case, essentially stippling on orange, because I know how it's going to work. I know that it's going to dry a little bit more muted than it goes on, so I can get away with it, and I know how to do it. But experiment. Just play with it. And trust that the colors you see, like how metal rusts and how metal tarnishes, use those colors, and you're going to be safe. And if you don't have the technical paints, water down like Hawk Turquoise or whatever that color is now, or like I use the Flaming Orange or Blazing Orange paint, works the exact same way.
Talking about Nilox Oxide, there's other applications for it other than just the weathering. And I don't want to get too far down the rabbit hole here. But if you go to the On the Brush Studios Facebook page, it was also shared on the Forge Narrative page. I've been working on, like we referenced earlier in the show, a Dark Angels Force. The first model I did was an Interrogator Chaplain in Terminator armor. You can't miss it. And he has that lantern piece that comes up, and it's got the flame coming out of it. And it's got this nice kind of glowing, ghosty effect to it. That's Nilox Oxide. All it was a base coat of white with Nilox Oxide, and then I airbrushed a little bit of white on the tips.
They used that in one of the most recent Wood Elf tutorials on the Games Workshop YouTube page.
They stole it from me.
Maybe they did. They could
probably
have.
Not. But it's it works. It works like a glaze. It's just a chalkier glaze, and you could do so many cool things with it, especially if you're going for ghost effects or even OSL effects. It's a very simple solution if you don't have it.
It also takes a little while to dry. So if you put it on and you don't exactly like how it looks, dip your brush in the water and mess with it until it gets to where you want.
Paul's right on point there.
And I know this because it just happened to me. I got too much. I wanted to have the oxide running down the stone and coming off the metal. And I didn't like how it collected in one spot. I stared at it for a minute or two, you know, and got it blended it to where I wanted it to go. Without messing up my model. So don't be intimidated. If you guys want to try it, and I hope we made this hobby talk as interesting as possible, but don't be afraid. And the technical paints are a good place to start. They're kind of designed to work the right way. You can also use your layer paints and just use them sparingly. And there's a bunch of different ways how to apply this stuff. Thanks a lot for listening. Do y'all have anything to add before we wrap up?
It's like a Zen moment for painting for me. I'm going to try this weathering stuff out.
All right, guys. Y'all have a good rest of y'all's night.
You too. Thanks for listening, hobbyists.
Thanks, team.
Peace out.
Thanks for listening.